Campus FM presents a talk by Dr. Lino German entitled The Human Embryo in Philosophy, Science and the Law. The talk was organized by the Philosophy Society.
Good evening to you all. The main topic of conversation in bioethical circles these last few years has been stem cell research. A development for which various therapeutic benefits have been predicted for dealing with a variety of hitherto untreatable disabling conditions. Dissenting voices have been insisting that scientists should not be given a free hand in such sensitive areas and that there ought to be limits to such forays into the uncharted territory of the building blocks of life. The fundamental ethical issue that underlines such procedures is not so much the claimed therapeutic benefits that may be derived from such research as the provenance of the stem cells and the fate of the early embryo following the harvesting of the stem cells from its inner cell mass. There is, in fact, no ethical objection to harvesting stem cells from adult tissues or from the umbilical cord of newborn infants. The scope of this presentation is to review briefly the concept of human personhood and to highlight the scientific evidence that lends support to the thesis that despite its microscopic dimensions, the early embryo does have the necessary characteristics that would justify it being accorded the full rights enjoyed by a newborn infant from the moment of its birth. Few will doubt that when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was being drawn up in 1948 in the context of the atrocities perpetrated against the Jews in the 30s and 40s and the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi war criminals involved, part of the intended meaning of rights in the Declaration was the understanding that there is a moral law above civil law. In the two covenants, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, both of which were finally agreed upon after nearly 20 years of debate, the concepts of inherent dignity and inalienability impart to these rights a distinctive prescriptive content. Both covenants state in their principles that all human beings are Both covenants state in their preambles that all human rights are based on the concept of human dignity. At that time, dignity was believed to belong to every member of the human family. But unfortunately, the rot had already set in. Though recognizing the right to life, many nations qualified it in regard to the unborn child, so that in Western culture today, human dignity appears to have lost its sense of equality of all the members of the family. It has come to mean the isolated individualism represented by the word autonomy, and constitutes a distancing of the individual from the rest of the community. The fundamental question of the moral status of the early human embryo remains one of the most controversial topics in current bioethical discourse, despite the fact that the concept of personhood has been the subject of controversy and debate for centuries. In ancient Greece, circa 500 BC, Plato and Aristotle distinguished between a person, a possessor of rights, and a non-person. Both philosophers regarded women, children, and slaves as objects rather than persons. About 500 years later, Roman law still recognized as a person every being who had rights and classified as a thing everything that could be considered as the object of the rights of a person. Roman law was also vested the male head of a household with the power of life and death over his wife, his children, and his slaves. From Roman times until the 16th century, European law was a melting pot of Roman law and Roman Catholic canon law. Intense debate between theologians and philosophers of the time produced various justifications for property, but the recognition of women, children, and slaves as persons rather than property did not form part of these debates. The focus on the significance of the individual person began to change with the growing influence of Christianity and the Catholic Church. Canonical courts were set up by the Church to resolve territorial disputes. Although the applicability of canon law was limited to the subjects of the Church, the system eventually grew to incorporate Roman law and eventually civil law. The status of women did not begin to change until the middle to the late 19th century. The historical legal status of children has also been fraught with obstacles, and the plight of slaves did not change until 1772. Various attempts have been made throughout the history of philosophy to define the human person. Thomas Aquinas clarified Boethius' original definition, observing that the words individual substance appearing in Boethius' definition of person signify a complete substance subsisting in its own right and separately from others. For Aquinas, therefore, it was the whole individual substance or entity with a rational nature that constituted a human person. Between the 14th and the 16th century, the various positions of moral theologians did not add the significant contributions to the question of animation of the human embryo. The common acceptance of the doctrine of fetus formatus, and therefore of the theory of delayed animation, led to logical consequences that would be extremely difficult to justify today. Further progress was stifled by the conceptual impasse in which theological thought seems to have been entangled until the 17th century, when a reversal came about in the wake of new scientific discoveries. For the first time, the debate on the status of the human embryo was being guided by the natural sciences instead of by philosophy and theology. This shift made possible the availability of some objective evidence on which ethical reasoning could be based. At the same time, however, it created the environment for a certain amount of discord between scientific and philosophical thought that has lingered on to the present time. The definition of humanum forms the basis of all serious discussion on what constitutes a human being. Some modern philosophers have proposed a definition of personhood based on brain-related criteria. While Immanuel Kant saw rational willing agency as the essential characteristic of persons, John Locke saw the ability to think combined with self-awareness over time as the essence of personhood. One of the consequences of adopting either the Lockean or the Kantian criteria is that not all living human beings would ipso facto qualify as persons. Embryos, fetuses, very young infants, and humans with severely damaged or defective brains may be able neither to think nor to be self-aware, and if the Kantian requirement of rational agency is to be met, many older children and some adults will fail to qualify as persons. The idea that living human beings can be persons at some stage of their lives and not at others gives rise to many sorts of philosophical difficulties, especially problems falling within the concept of identity. Personhood is a philosophical concept, and scientific information alone can never settle questions of a philosophical nature. Philosophically, given that an entity acts specifically according to its nature or what it is, if the zygote is derived from human parents and has the complement of 46 chromosomes that characterizes the species Homo sapiens, it is a member of that species and is therefore a human being. We can also conclude that a substantial change occurs when the nuclear genetic material of the male and female pronuclei of the respective gametes merge to form the new genome. Any changes that occur thereafter represent a series of accidental changes with no corresponding change in the nature of the developing conceptus. If the early human conceptus exists independently as a whole, self-identical, unified being, then it is an individual substance, an individual of the human species. It is not a possible or a potential human being, but a presently existing real human being, albeit of microscopic dimensions. If the early conceptus is human in origin, then it is human. The current controversy about the personhood of the early human embryo has two centers. The first, which is empirical, focuses on the question whether the best information available supports the view that individuality and the integrated function of the new organism are established at fertilization. The second, which is philosophical, raises questions about how to interpret the scientific data. What aspects of human existence does the term person denote? What is the relevance to present moral standing of the potential to actualize personal characteristics? When turning to science for assistance in determining the status of the early human conceptus, one must therefore keep two things constantly in mind. The first is that science by itself is not competent to decide the question of personhood. The second is that this notwithstanding, the conclusions of science do provide a valuable indication for rational deliberations about personhood. In other words, although science alone cannot decide the question of personhood, neither can the question of personhood be decided without science. There is, on the whole, a very broad agreement among embryologists concerning the scientific facts. Disagreement between biologists and philosophers tends to occur when the scientific data are interpreted in relation to the beginning of the new human individual. Contemporary philosophers such as Peter Singer have defined a person as a rational, self-conscious being. Similarly, John Harris defines a person as any individual capable of valuing its own life. Dame Mary Warnock, on the other hand, maintains that since there seems to be no separately satisfactory way of distinguishing a person from a non-person, apart from their supposedly having rights, one should forego any attempt to decide what is to count as a person on the criteria of rationality and self-value, but opt instead for the direct route forward and ask whether or not the human embryos have rights. It seems strange, therefore, how the Warnock report should draw the demarcation line arbitrarily at day 14 of embryological development. The underlying premise of functionalism that seems to be gaining ground in bioethics is the claim that personhood is definable in terms of function or behavior. A functionalist approach may be appropriate for scientific purposes, but is hardly adequate for ordinary reason or common sense, much less for good philosophy or morality, which should be based on common sense. This is because common sense acknowledges the distinction between what one is and what one does, between being and function, and thus between being a person and functioning as a person. One cannot function as a person without first being a person, but one can surely be a person without functioning as such. Functioning as a person is a sign and an effect of being a person. It is because of what we are, because of our nature or essence or being, that we can and do function in certain ways. Characteristics such as rational attributes, sentience, moral autonomy, etc., are seen as only activities of powers which are of secondary consideration because they are consequent to or follow upon the actual nature of that substance. It was the dualism of René Descartes and the consequent historical breaking off to either rationalism or empiricism that gave rise to the distinctions writers make between a human being and a human person. What is needed is a definition which does not split the human being from the human person, and which does not consist only a part of the human being of which we have experience. Once the biological facts are correctly understood, it should not be all that difficult to define a human being. From empirical observations, we can draw our philosophical concepts of personhood, and these concepts should reflect as accurately as possible those biological facts. Otherwise, we are not philosophizing about the real world at all. Logically, personhood should begin when the human being begins. Modern biology teaches us that our ancestors are united to their progeny by a continuous link that joins one generation to another. In general, therefore, human life can be said to be a continuum. Each individual human life, however, has a very neat beginning that coincides with the formation of a new genome, the end result of the process of fertilization. An important discovery was made in the second half of the 17th century by Reinier de Graaf, who described the ovarian Graafian follicle that bears his name. Along with other anatomists, he held that the ovary was a much more active participant in the process of generation than had previously been thought, and concluded that it was the seat of the formation of the human being. Some years later, Anton van Leeuwenhoek identified in the microscope the spermatozoa in whose head he believed there was contained the homunculus that the ovists had previously presumed to be located in the ovary. About a century later, the cellular theory of Rudolf Virchow and the perfection of microscopic techniques made possible the identification of nuclear genetic material in the gametes, from whose union derives the zygote, the first cell displaying the full genome of a new individual. It was this progress in scientific knowledge that finally led to the abandonment of the theory of fetal preformation and gave precious support to the thesis of the human status of the embryo from conception. Over the past few decades, technologies have been developed that are capable of compromising the course of embryological development, impeding implantation of the embryo into the uterine lining. Direct intervention on embryos, such as stem cell harvesting from the inner cell mass of the blastocyst, has also been made possible, especially on embryos generated by in vitro fertilization. One can identify two sources of motivation in the ensuing discourse about the status of the human embryo. The first, more proper to the philosopher and the theologian, is to re-examine in the light of new scientific findings or conceptual developments a position that was held to be already established. The second, more pragmatic and at times frankly utilitarian, stems from the desire of the scientific researcher to seek philosophical legitimacy for certain interventions on the human embryo. These interventions include the cryopreservation, freezing of the embryo in liquid nitrogen, non-therapeutic experimentation, ectogenesis, and even the taking of the embryo's life. Major scientific and philosophical arguments have been used in support of the sudden appearance of personhood at different biological landmarks, indicating that such arguments are grounded on scientific data that are incorrect or misapplied, and that the philosophical claims of these arguments are grounded in systems of philosophy that are themselves problematic, with highly indefensible definitions of human being and human person. Although the question about the nature, the essence of a human being seems to be fundamentally a philosophical one, any philosophical reflection, analysis, or account about the nature of a human being must begin with the empirically observable scientific facts. Only in this way will it be possible to have a realistic and objectively based definition of a human being, one that is not relativistic. It is critical that we recognize the importance of making correct use of the biological facts in consideration of a definition of a human person. In our attempts to determine exactly at what stage during embryological development it may be claimed that there is a human person present. The massive confusion on the truth about scientific facts of the early human embryo created by the legal decisions of the Connecticut Supreme Court in the United States in the 1993 case Roe versus Wade is a case in point. Scientifically, there is no question whatsoever that the immediate product of fertilization is a new, genetically unique, living human being, flatly contradicting the ruling of this court that it is just a body part of the mother. Once false science becomes incorporated into law or regulation, it ceases to be science anymore and becomes instead what is known in legal jargon as stare decisis, or legal precedent. Apparently, the Supreme Court has no legal duty to go back and correct the false science, and therefore the decision is likely to continue to be applied and perpetuated as a legal precedent. The landmarks in embryological development taken as indicators of the moral status of the human conceptus range from fertilization to birth. But the most highlighted indicators are those that occur in the very early stages of embryological development. Fertilization does not happen in a moment, like a bolt from the blue. Fertilization is a process that starts with the first contact of the male and female gametes, syngamy, passing through an intermediate stage when the parental nuclei, pronuclei, are still separate within the fertilized egg, and comes to an end with the formation of the new individual genome that results from the admixture of the genetic material of the male and female pronuclei, karyogamy, to form the zygote. While it is true that development in individual human life is a continuous and uninterrupted process from its beginning right up to the death of the organism, for ease of comprehension and analysis, it is convenient to examine each process in isolation, always bearing in mind that each process merges imperceptibly into the next, without any gaps in between. Like all processes, fertilization has a starting point, an interface, and an end product or objective. The whole process may take up to 22 to 24 hours, and when completed, the formation of the new genome heralds the beginning of a new human individual life with its own distinctive DNA. The process of becoming that is proper to every biological creature necessarily implies development in continuity and identity in being. Until that part of the fertilization process has been completed, therefore, one cannot, strictly speaking, talk of a human embryo in being. The chain of events which begins the moment the zygote is formed indicates that the two gametes no longer operate as independent entities, but now constitute a new entity that functions as one unit, that is, it is ontologically one being. Its orientation and function, its orientation and determination is fundamentally due to the new genome or genetic information housed in it. The main scientific indicators which science can provide may be summarized as follows. Each somatic cell of the human conceptus has 46 chromosomes. This number remains unchanged throughout the individual's normal lifespan, that is, from fertilization till the death of that organism. Spermatozoa and oocytes have half that number, that is, 23 chromosomes. All the genetic information carried in the nucleus and the mitochondrial nuclear information in the cytoplasm of the zygote is responsible for causing virtually all of the processes throughout embryological development. The empirical facts are that specifically human proteins, enzymes, cells, tissues, and organs, in short, the formation of the entire human body is directed from the original zygote. Variations from the normal developmental pattern, such as twinning and mosaic function, do not negate the individuation of the original zygote. They are explainable in terms of the nature of that particular zygote itself, because either because of its internal genetic constitution or because of external circumstances that initiate these changes. Horticulturists can teach us a thing or two about what happens to the original plant when cuttings are taken from it and successfully planted into the soil. It is a form of asexual reproduction. Advances in scientific research and reproductive technology are today implying questions about the value and protectability of human life in its earliest stages, to which in vitro fertilization now gives easier access. The first definition that needs to be tackled is that concerning the beginning of individual human life, and it is here that one begins to encounter difficulties. The issue is often obscured in our society through misunderstanding, misinterpretation, and sometimes misrepresentation of the biological facts. Scientifically, the prevalent view appears to be that individual human life has its origin with the formation of the new genome that gives each particular embryo an individual identity. Some bioethicists, however, hold that as soon as the sperm penetrates the egg, the genetic constitution of the zygote will already have been determined, for the fertilized ovum will automatically prevent the penetration of other sperms. In my view, a more definite landmark for the beginning of individual human life is the end stage of the fertilization process, when the genetic material merges to produce the genome of the zygote. The rapid progress that has taken place in scientific knowledge has rendered technically feasible interventions on the human embryo that formerly would have been relegated to the realm of science fiction. Techniques have been developed that compromise the course of development of the conceptus by impeding implantation in the uterine wall. On the other hand, direct interventions on embryos have been made possible, especially on embryos generated in vitro. These include cryopreservation that constitutes an abusive interference with the life cycle of the embryo, pre-implantation diagnosis with a view to embryo selection for subsequent implantation, commercialization of embryos and embryonic stem cell harvesting, and experimentation. Advancing the limits of the possible inevitably raises the problem of new limits that have to determine the realm of what is licit, both from the ethical and the juridical point of view. Today, a synthesis between scientific data, philosophical speculation, and issues in the humanities has become a pressing necessity for dealing with the ethical, social, and juridical problems that have emerged as a result of man's interference in many aspects and stages of human life. One needs to emphasize here that science provides the latest, but definitely not the last word about the human embryo, for science itself is subject to change, and scientific conclusions may need to be revised in the light of new discoveries. On the other hand, it is important that both philosophy and law be guided by the established scientific data of the day where the human embryo is concerned. The concept of personhood serves a dual function. It helps to protect those considered persons from suffering the hurts and indignities that the selfish tendencies of human psychology could inflict upon them. And it helps to justify treating these creatures, those creatures not considered persons, selfishly. To classify certain beings as persons is to grant them moral and legal rights that protect them from being treated as nothing, but as a means to human ends. To deny such rights is to permit such beings to be used as property or creatures of nature existing for the sake of human satisfaction. The ethical status of the human embryo is a principle of juridical legality. From the ethical viewpoint, this indicates the need for juridical standards with regard to the good of the embryonic life. From the viewpoint of law, on the other hand, this makes evident the tie of juridical legality to references of value expressed by the ethics of life. To say that legal capacity is a right for each human being is to affirm that the life of the embryo should be protected because it is a fundamental right and not because it serves someone and is therefore worthy of protection. There is no doubt that the new capacity for intervention in the earliest stages of human embryological development, together with the possibility of novel therapeutic perspectives, implies new possibilities of harming the developing embryo. The legislator must seek to provide a legal discipline that will be adequate not only for existing realities, but also for meeting, as far as is possible, foreseeable future developments. The new possibilities for intervention in the prenatal stage of human existence pose particular problems with regard to the juridical protection of life. As far as in vitro fertilization is concerned, the key provision should be to prevent the production of surplus embryos. The procedure is associated with the loss of a large number of fertilized eggs, but this can hardly be justified by recalling that in nature there is also a significant loss of embryos, both those that fail to implant and those whose existence the mother is never aware of. Whatever the percentage of this loss, it is very debatable that man is authorized artificially to replicate the natural event. If we do not accept the distinction between naturally occurring and man-made events, we might as well proceed to eliminate homicide from our criminal code, because there is no event that is more natural than death. On this basis, the classical norms which aim at protecting life, those concerning abortion and murder, refer to conduct that is directly harmful to human experience during a phase of development that can be more or less advanced. Today, the picture has changed completely. The action of man today can be directed not only to the phase of which human life has already begun, but also to the moment of its generation, in the case of embryos generated by IVF. The post-fecundation phase does not proceed to its own power towards implantation, but requires intervention in order to allow the possibility of further development by means of embryo transfer. Legislation helps to protect virtually every segment of our society: battered women, abused children, laws strengthening drug and alcohol-related crimes, and so on. One glaring weakness, however, has been our apparent reluctance to enact legislation that fully protects unborn children from harm. It seems rather odd that while the law recognizes corporations as legal persons, it has hesitated to accord an equivalent status to the unborn human embryo. Years ago, a landmark Supreme Court decision, the highest court in the United States, set an artificial mark which concluded that personhood begins only at a certain point during pregnancy. The right of the mother to do with her body what she wished simply outweighed the rights of the unborn child she carried. Medical evidence over the years has repeatedly confirmed that the unborn child is a separate being. The court created a legal environment where, according to the law, child and mother were seen as one. Since that Roe versus Wade decision, many states have tried to help give unborn children the same protection of safety and security that we all enjoy. Currently, for example, 32 American states have laws on their books that protect the unborn. Does our law reflect current scientific realities? In many countries, including Malta, juridical capacity or legal personality is not acquired before birth. The embryo is thereby denied the title of one possessing the fundamental rights, rights to life, to health, to personal integrity, to dignity, etc., or its position is differentiated with regard to the protection of these rights. This is because the situation that prevails in Malta, except for the legal provisions outlawing abortion and, more recently, the government plans to entrench this law into the constitution of Malta, for which planes are afoot, and other provisions that safeguard the unborn child's right of inheritance, the legitimate. The fact that the norms in matters of homicide and of grievous bodily harm are traditionally referred to postnatal life does not imply that the juridical order has taken a position against protection of human existence in its present prenatal stage. Rather, it reflects a division due to the objective fact that until a few decades ago, the aggressions perpetuated against the unborn in practice were all included in abortifacient conduct. Until today, the norms protecting human existence, aside from the area of abortion, have still not been affirmed to have an applicability in principle to prenatal life. With regard to prenatal life, the anchoring to one or other type of sanction is not the issue at stake, but rather the preoccupation that there be protection and that this be effective. One has to keep in mind the fact that many of the injuries perpetrated against prenatal human life are very difficult to ascertain without the collaboration of the sanitary structures. It follows that the strategy of protection for the developing embryo must be, above all, one of so-called anticipatory prevention that aims to regulate the medical and research activities so as to render it difficult a priori to realize any illicit practices that is not wanting to intervene until they have already been realized. In Malta, a parliamentary committee on social affairs is about to conclude consultations, submissions from various sectors of Maltese society in connection with proposed legislation intended to regulate procedures in assisted procreation to ensure compliance with human rights provisions. Such an exercise should provide an excellent opportunity to eradicate the present legal anomaly of limiting legal personhood to a life-born infant. Government has an obligation to protect its citizens, all citizens, and the law needs to ensure that equal rights are accorded to prenatal as well as postnatal life. Such a relatively small step by the legislature would indeed be a giant step for mankind. It would ensure that justice is not only done, but also seen to be done. Thank you for your attention.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I thank the Philosophy Society and extend my gratitude to Dr. Lino German for this kind invitation and indeed privilege to address the Philosophy Society. Indeed, to address a philosophical society when one can hardly call oneself a philosopher shows the great respect that philosophers have for public opinion. Moreover, I make no claim that I am versant in the law, and indeed, to come in front of a Maltese audience and criticize a proposal to entrench the embryo within our law would be a crazy act, to say the least. And I say this in a positive sense, because it shows as well the virtue of our people to stand by its principles. I will, however, make a few suggestions which hopefully will strengthen our understanding and positions, as I feel that some of the proposals put forward, albeit backed by some scientific evidence, may endanger the status of the embryo rather than protect it. I say this with all sincerity and moral conscience to my own traditional and moral beliefs. Human life should be protected, it is already protected, but if we are to support this protection, we must respect a moral certainty and indeed a logical sincerity which will therefore not render positions frail and built, as it were, on sand. In this regard, we must respect not only science, but also philosophy, and perhaps this is the point where I would vary, although respect Dr. German's position, who views that law and philosophy must be preceded by science. I would say that the law must respect the normative value of a people, and that normative values are a matter of sound philosophical and moral reasoning. Science gives us facts. To use science as proof is tantamount to expose oneself to the same criticism that statisticians may have. One chooses the ingredients of the cake one wants to bake, and most doctors have this experience when facing medical representatives who choose the statistics, albeit valid research, which suits their arguments and products. Thus, we would all agree that human life should be sacrosanct, and what academy finds difficult to define is conception. Some see conception as the very beginning of the meeting of gametes, others as the meeting of pronuclei and the formation of DNA, and yet others at a stage where we have some form of tissue substance with which one can identify with a body and perhaps a mind as a seat of a soul. The latter is less popular, although still has support amongst Catholic theologians. The zygote stage is the one chosen by Donum Vitae. The problem, as I see it, is choosing the word personhood or person and substituting it for human being and or human life. Indeed, when one uses a logic which goes like this, human life, one cell, is a human being, a person is a human being, hence human life is a person. The falsity of this argument is perhaps best identified in philosophy or psychology of language, which would immediately point out that the term human being is being used in a different sense in the first two premises. In one, it is ontological, in the second, it is common parlance. Without going into the merit that not all persons need be human life, there is a clear weakness when one refers to a fertilized egg as a person in its own right. One can definitely refer to it as human life, and one can definitely confer on it the same moral status. To call it a person and support that argument by science has weaknesses and faults, in my opinion. One does not, in usual common language, refer to the fertilized egg of a cow as a cow. Similarly, one does not refer to the fertilized egg of a monkey as a monkey, and neither does one call the fertilized egg of a donkey a donkey. Yet we are insisting on calling the fertilized egg of a person a person. A fertilized egg is not a tissue. It is a unicellular entity, human life indeed, but not in its nature as other unicellular animals to remain unicellular. Indeed, there are colonies like sponges which, although seen as a unit entity, are recognized as a collection of cells, and if divided into 100 pieces, will develop into 100 different entities. And the Moriella stage has been described as the evolutionary consequence of a colony, which is why it can still divide into twins or triplets, etc. This does not mean it is not a unit, but in its nature it still has to develop, and only its genetics and or environmental factors will determine whether it will remain as one unit or divide. It has been argued that it is a scientific fact that the singular entity begins at the stage when the two pronuclei meet to form the zygote. Whilst this scientific fact is true, it does not stand alone. Ask biologists when life begins, and they will say at fertilization. It would be safer, therefore, to take the beginning of fertilization, as even here the genes have been naturally selected, and unless interfered with, they will unite. Distinguishing a before and an after of unity is tantamount to being arbitrary, and therefore there is nothing to stop us from considering other valid scientific points to which the zygote is relatively behind in time and space. Even if the process of fertilization has a beginning and an end, in reality there are many beginnings and ends of various stages, and there is no clear-cut line distinguishing them. There cannot even be a point where we can say we have new DNA, as the cell immediately starts to divide, the mechanism of which probably starts before the fusion is complete. The zygote in this argument is given importance because of the newly united DNA. But scientifically, this DNA is only, and one must insist on this point, only a template. although we see the cell in its nature to develop further. A song is the pleasant or unpleasant sound that one perceives. It is not the record disc. One may identify the song with the record, and even protect it if it were the last recording on earth, and protect it with one's life and entrench it into the law. But it remains the fact that the record is the recording, the template, and not the song itself. We often identify the physical entity with the eidetic phenomenological reduction. A zygote, I repeat, is human life. It is not yet a human being in the sense of personhood. We may still protect it, but if we insist on calling it a person, we continue to expose ourselves to criticism. This brings me, in a short parenthesis, to St. Thomas and St. Augustine, who many would brush away as imbeciles. May I humbly point out that they knew that something, a tissue, existed beforehand. The difficulty they found in identifying personhood was not due to the fact, often quoted, that they did not possess the scientific knowledge that we have today. I do not think that they were that naive. They could simply have said that life starts at the beginning, but were unable to identify where this beginning exists. Instead, they argued that one must identify two things, movement and a seat for mind. They recognized a form and the stage of pre-form. If science had to give it support, if indeed it needed to give it support, I think it would be at this stage. My experience, in fact, with some Erasmus students has shown that even those who are atheists and believe in abortion as a right could, by normal reasoning on their own, arrive to the conclusion that you cannot abort once you have something to identify with a body. Since this stage is only 14 days or less into the development of the zygote, they all conclude that abortion cannot be allowed because by the time the woman knows she is pregnant, these 14 days would invariably have passed. One can then make one see that even if one does not identify earlier stages as a person, they are still human life, and as human life, many would argue in favor of rights. This has been my positive experience using facilitative rather than a didactic approach with students. In fact, it is the question of rights which often makes us assert that the zygote is a person in its own right. We fear that someone will create zygotes for experimental use. But fears have made us conceal the truth, probably through an emotional blindness, which is perhaps the function of phenomenology as a philosophical model to debunk. The unconcealment of truth, as Heidegger put it, will lead us to authenticity that many philosophers speak about, which is hidden behind what the public, the day, would want us to believe. A word later elaborated by Merleau-Ponty and Sartre, and worth dedicating indeed another session in this regard alone. I refer to the use of authenticity. If an institution recognizes the zygote, then we must state that this is our true reason. But to try deliberately to push aside religious beliefs in a deliberate attempt to prove that the zygote can be proved scientifically to be the point where personhood starts is, I think, a deliberate abuse of science and choosing one of the many points which science suggests. The truth is, science does not tell us where personhood starts. It cannot, and it is not in its nature to do so. This is only a question of consensus and moral reflection. Science can, however, tell you where human life begins, and I humbly would point out that it begins in the beginning of the beginning and not at the end of the beginning. Therefore, the sooner we stop identifying human life with personhood, the sooner we can have a productive dialogue, but the sooner we rid ourselves of the idea that human life is equivalent to a human being in the sense of personhood, the sooner we will be able to deal effectively with the large issues raised by the new use of new medical technologies. Moreover, the sooner we rid ourselves of the idea that human life is in any way of less moral value than a person, the sooner we will realize that creating hundreds of human life forms is not a morally neutral phenomenon. There are, however, reasons for identifying the zygote. The first is to allow polar body biopsy. This would indeed be a good thing. The second is to disallow the creation of human life for stem cells and other uses. On this issue, our moral theologians have indeed the duty and responsibility to tell us whether polar body biopsy therefore would be allowable, allowing for the fact that if the biopsy reveals a genetic disorder, it will be discarded in the pre-zygote stage. Moreover, this would mean extending IVF also to couples with hereditary conditions and clearly stating that this would not be eugenics, which involves the elimination not of diseases, but of persons. Certainly, everybody has seemed to shy away from giving these answers whilst bowing in favor of it. Secondly, a clarification of these definitions would allow us to have a better discussion on stem cells, for we have omitted discussing seriously the ethics of stem cell research and instead focused on the status of the embryo. Stem cell research, even if the stem cells are obtained from adults, still have its moral considerations. Indeed, the term body spare parts is used rhetorically only when referring to the embryo. It is a pejorative term which lowers the discussion to unacceptable levels in serious dialogue, as are accusations of relativism, fundamentalism, etc. A final word on entrenching the word conception in the Constitution. Whilst I am not a legal person, I think it would be dangerous to use a word which, as we have seen, is hard to define. Conversely, defining it at the zygote stage is challengeable, as we have seen. It would also make challengeable the whole concept of IVF, in vitro fertilization, for there is, as has been pointed out, a statistical loss of human life in this process which is unavoidable, but which has so far been acceptable because they are all given the same chance. Therefore, even in the present law regulating IVF, may find itself being challenged as unconstitutional. Unless this is what some people are contemplating, I would take this into consideration. If this is what they are contemplating, however, they should morally make their intentions clear so that a healthy discussion can occur. Moral sincerity rather than tactical maneuvers is what we require. To conclude, I think we are often guilty of an emotional blindness and a paranoid overprotectionism. Epistemology is the study to our right to the beliefs we have. We start from what we might call our cognitive stances and ask whether we are right to hold those stances. Doing proper epistemology may require the reverse of this. We must study the facts well and then ask whether we need to uphold or change our cognitive stances. In this regard, I prefer eidetic phenomenological reduction, which allows us to shift our focus from particular instances of perception to a property of what that perception is in its essence. To conclude, if one were to refer to personhood as the beginning of fertilization, I would say no. If one were to refer to the zygote as personhood, I would say no, but would of course submit myself autonomously to my fate, but that is another matter outside the scope of this academic exercise. If one were to refer to the beginning of fertilization as human life, I would say yes. If one were to give the same moral status of human life to personhood, I would say yes. And if one were to promote further dialogue in understanding where personhood actually begins, I would say yes. We need to promote a dialogue enriched by two principles which patristic fathers had coined in accordance with their true Trinitarian unity, that of emptying oneself of preconceived ideas, kenosis, in order to make oneself one in understanding the other, perichoresis. This protects us from emotional blindness and deafness and guarantees a moral and logical sincerity in our outcomes, such as recent discussions to use dead embryos previously frozen for the source of stem cells. I hope I have adhered to my time, and I thank you again for listening.
There are interesting points of difference or divergence between them. It's not just that. There may be other points raised by the two speakers which we might want to disagree. We are not here to sing as a choir. There can be dissonance. And of course, this is what we are here for. Please use the roving mic when you're going to talk, because we'd like to register this. Thank you. Can I start by asking a question myself, okay? Dr. Jaman, you seem to be saying that science cannot really help us define the concept of a person, because the concept of a person is a philosophical-legal concept. And I think that Dr. Malia seems to agree with you about that. So why were you here? Why were you presenting that initial part of your speech as a sort of disagreement with Dr. Jaman?
Yes, well, I think the original version of the script that I had may have varied in this regard. I don't know whether there was any particular sentence which was changed. I certainly felt in the concluding part where we refer to the law that the definition of a zygote was being based on scientific fact. Certainly it is scientific fact. Certainly it is a point one can choose. But what I am saying is that there are other valid scientific points, and to use only the scientific facts which sort of would appeal to oneself is what statisticians might often do in using the statistics that appeal to them to arrive to certain conclusions. This is certainly possible, as we often see in the medical field. I feel that science cannot, therefore, dictate that the zygote should be the stage that that personhood begins, just because we have the formation of DNA. If anything, there are two other extreme points. One is before the DNA starts, and there are also stages after the DNA. So I think that is our main point of difference.
Well, then, couldn't one say that one should follow the suggestion made by Mary Warnock that we should not discuss these matters in terms of persons at all?
Yes.
Right? Well, of course, then Mary Warnock goes on to say we should discuss them in terms of rights. That creates a problem for me, because traditionally the concept of a person was also strictly linked to the concept of a right. That is, a person is an individual, a subject that has rights. So that second statement she makes is, for me, very difficult to comply with. But having said that, maybe one should at this stage concentrate on this idea of, if you like, how to define a human being. Because that itself creates problems. Dr. Jaman.
Well, I believe that unless philosophy takes a cue from science about the known facts of the day, because science can change, obviously, it will not be talking correctly in philosophical terms.
No. With regard to the definition of a human being,
yes,
I think that it needs to take a cue from science. I'm not denying that. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Well, the problem, as I see it, arose as a result of René Descartes, who decided to interpret the soul, in inverted commas, as an entity upon itself, creating two entities, the body and the soul. And this was the origin of the distinction between a human person and a human being. The human person being identified with the soul, and a human being being identified with the body.
One need not accept the Cartesian picture.
Yes.
But we would still have a problem. I mean, you can't pin an argument on a false picture.
No. The problem seems to be that if you're going to define an entity, you cannot give two definitions. And the two should logically coincide in what they convey, what the two definitions convey. And to me, the nature of the substance is more important than what it does, what it is capable of doing. And therefore, this is the reason why I would identify I would refute the distinction between a human being and a human person, because it is based on brain-related criteria that are the equivalent of accidental changes in the course of a normal development of a human embryo.
Yes, but one doesn't need to be a Cartesian to say that. I mean, traditionally, the nature or essence of something was always defined in terms of what it can do, that is, in terms of its functions, in terms of what it is capable of performing.
That may be true for science, I suppose.
Well, it's also true for a certain type of philosophy, not Cartesian.
It's a difficult area.
Can I just add I find the term human being problematic, because one often can confuse what is meant by human being in an academic sense and what is meant by human being in a colloquial everyday life sense, which is why I referred to psychology and language. I think certainly if you call the first cell, irrespective of whether the pronuclei have met to form the single cell, is a cell, it is a living. There are certainly cells which have no nuclei, blood cells, about 50% or so of skin cells. So the fact that a cell has a nucleus does not define it as being a cell in its own right. And definitely it is human life that will develop, so one that can certainly, in the ontological sense, I would say, once use the word human being insofar as you're using being as entity, a human entity. But one has to be careful, because even my little finger is a human entity. So there is some difference there. But certainly you can use the word human being for that cell. But when we apply the term human being to persons, of course a human being is a person. But the word that human being there is being extrapolated into a different sense. And this is the main problem I find with the logical sequence of a zygote is a human being, a person is a human being, and therefore a zygote is a person. Because I think human being is being used in a different sense. I would be interested, however, in what Professor Wayne would have to say about this. Yeah.
I tend to agree with Dame Warnock on this. I think that debate about the concept of personhood and what constitutes a person takes us into into a labyrinth out of which there is no exit. What I wanted to say is that there are different, I think, you know, basically we can pick up on her suggestion that we should talk about rights rather than about persons, because I don't think that rights are necessarily connected with persons. I think that moral rights are necessarily connected with persons. But I do not. I think that there are other kinds of rights than moral rights, such as political rights, legal rights, etc., etc. And I think that connecting the idea of rights with persons is problematic in another way also. Because once we start connecting rights with persons, then we say that only persons have rights. And that creates an argument against, which basically is based on a charge of speciesism, that, you know, we happen to privilege persons as carriers of rights because we happen to be human beings ourselves. And it sort of rules out the possibility of another kind of discourse, like, for instance, whether animals should have rights and so on and so forth, which is an area which I think, you know, we should certainly not close off, because I think that animals do have rights, but or should have rights. But I think that basically I would agree with Dame Warnock that we should not, you know, waste our time basically on the on discussing the question of personhood, and instead we should go ahead, you know, more or less as you suggested earlier on, discussing in a rational way, you know, where we are going to place our legal rights and obligations and so on.
Yeah, I would sort of add to that and emphasize that just because we do not call human life, in the sense of one cell, a person, does not mean, as you're saying, that we cannot attribute rights. As you say, we attribute rights to animals, so why not to a zygote? But to attribute a label of personhood is indeed weakening the concept of the same rights you are trying to attribute to that human life.
It worries me that we seem to be taking the protection of human life from the animal rights point of view as an extension of animal rights. And well, it's being mentioned a bit too often. If I understand Dr. Malia well, you do agree that the protection of human life is an obligation, even if you would not agree that human life is a person and is labeled a person. And I do think that we do have an obligation to protect human life much more than we do to protect animal rights. The second thing that I wanted to point out is, if science is open to error, and Dr. German based his paper on the fact that in this philosophical legal, when discussing this philosophical and legal issue, we should take a cue from science. However, many times during your paper, you seem to give more weight to, it was not simply taking a cue from science, but you did say that one should base development of the argument on empirical facts. So on the one hand, in your explanation after, you were saying we should take a cue from science, which is pretty close to Dr. Malia's position. But during your paper, you seem to give much more weight to science when discussing this issue. I just leave it up.
Well, this is because I believe that philosophy by itself is not competent to explain the scientific details and relies very heavily on the scientific facts of the day in order to reach conclusions of a philosophical nature. One wants an example, for instance, in St. Thomas Aquinas' time, in the medieval times, Thomas Aquinas didn't place, the fact that Thomas Aquinas placed ensoulment not at conception, in inverted commas, or fertilization, but at some 40 days later, was in accordance with the science of his day. And as science changes, so philosophy has to change along with it. Otherwise, we're talking different languages. It doesn't mean that science is infallible. It means that to produce a proper picture for science, for philosophy, science must provide it with the data as are known today. Then they would be talking more or less the same language.
I would like to thank the speakers for their very profound expositions. I personally, of course, tend to agree with Dr. German, who if one looks at certain writers, I call to mind particularly Norman Ford, he very clearly delineates the difference between ontological continuity, which you referred to as the life cycle, human life, cycle of life, the continuity of life, and individual ontogeny or individual continuity. And I have no doubt, I have examined this to quite some depth, that individual ontogeny, that is the ontological development of the individual, specifically science shows us, starts at the formation of the zygote after karyogamy, at karyogamy. There are a lot of issues which point to this scientifically. At penetration, the number of chromosomes inside the ovum is 69. There is a misconception that at penetration the number of chromosomes is 46. The ovum at that stage has not completed what is called the second meiotic division. Therefore, the pronucleus in the ovum at penetration has doubled the complement of nuclei which is necessary for pronuclear fusion, which is why the second meiotic division takes place. You have the production of the second polar body where half the complement is rejected from the nucleus. And this takes place 2 to 8 hours after penetration. So we, at penetration, we are talking of an entity, a physical entity, with 69 chromosomes, which is definitely not the human entity. It is only at second meiotic division, after the second polar body has been rejected, that the normal haploids, that is half the chromosomes of the female pronucleus, is restored. So that when it unites with the male pronucleus, then you have the full complement, the 46 chromosomes. So there are other reasons. I don't want to be too technical. There are other reasons, what we call maternal to embryonic transfer, what we call zygotic genome activation. The actual embryo zygote is only activated after amphimixis, after karyogamy. Before there is karyogamy, the actual embryonic genome is still silent. It is silent translationally. There is some form of transcription, but it is silent translationally. And the actual new protein only starts to be laid down after after there is the zygotic genome activation. Prior to that, new protein has been found scientifically to be laid down by the maternal transcripts inside the ovum. That is, that up to the stage of the activation of the zygotic genome at karyogamy, it is the mother's genes that is regulating the whole process. So there is a paradigm shift. So this is why I think Dr. German is correct on this issue of human being. On the question of human being and human person, well, here we have to be very careful. Scientifically, I would talk about there being a human being. Human person, there are a lot of philosophical, legal, and other explanations which can define human personhood. But we have to be very careful here. We tend to look at the difference between, well, a human being, if given the capacity to develop and grow, will attain personhood. We all agree with this. Unless life is terminated for some reason, personhood is attained in a natural process. It could be, and this is where I pose my hypothesis, that we are looking at the difference between human being and human person in terms of Newtonian physics. Now, we all know, so there is a time lag between the existence of the human being and the capacitation to personhood. Now, we all know that Newtonian physics has been superseded. We know that time and distance are not absolute entities, they are relative entities. And Einstein very clearly pointed out that what to one person observing may be one phase in time, one presence, to another observing person at different velocities, at different speeds, may in fact present as a different phase of development. So it is possible, and at the same instant, for the same entity, physical entity, to be a human being to one person, as we have defined them here, and a human person to a totally different person. And here, I'm going to mention, this was Einstein's theory, it was proven. We know that at the speed of light, time stands still, so there can, time stands still till the same object can appear to have stood still, but to other persons it would not have stood still. But it is the same human entity. So concluding things equal to the same thing would be equal to one another. So here, again, one can equate human being with human person. That's the first point. A group of philosophers, maybe Professor Frigeri, blow this up more, who are called process philosophers, particularly Alfred North Whitehead. They had taken up Einstein's theory and very clearly putting forward the principle which I have just talked about, explained that whole of life is looked at as a process, and that the instances, the time instances, could be determinable according to the different perceptions of people who are looking at this specific entity. And of course, I want to round this up. This is very complicated, I know. That it's not easy to sometimes, if you haven't been thinking about these things, to grasp them immediately. But I have to here mention a person who has, I want to recall the 50th anniversary of his death, last April, who applied Whitehead's and Darwin's concepts to biological development and human development. And I am talking here about Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin was a process philosopher in the sense that Whitehead, he borrowed a lot from Whitehead, he borrowed a lot from Samuel Alexander, he borrowed a lot from Aristotle, and he borrowed a lot from Darwin. And unfortunately, maybe Teilhard de Chardin came a bit too early for his time, because Chardin's one of his principles, I do not agree with all his conclusions, but he was a very great man. And unfortunately, neither church nor states very often understood his reasoning. But Chardin has this principle of complexity consciousness. And he implies that consciousness is not only present in the sense we consider it to be, that is, in the fully developed human being with a mind which is rationally capable of thinking, but he also gives the information, the information which has evolved during evolution in the genome, he also calls consciousness, because of its highest, it is the highest degree of complexity in living life that has been found to this day. So Chardin says, listen, this information in the genome, and that's why I agree with Dr. Germain's definition of human being, because you have there the actual coming, the actual production of the final genome. This information in the genome is already a form of consciousness. And consciousness, as all psychologists will tell you, need not be cognitive. It can be also non-cognitive. When we make decisions, we make decisions also in the non-cognitive sphere. So his inference was that there already exists at the level of the human genome a form of consciousness. And therefore, that would make the human being also at that stage a human person. These are just thoughts I wanted to put forward, and obviously many of you will disagree with me, but that's why we're here.
So before I give the word to the speakers again, can I have, if there's anybody who would like to make short interventions now, then you're right, and then we'll give the word to the speakers for the final round. Okay?
At the risk of sounding facetious, I'd like to ask a question. If we combine the idea of personhood so much with the biological concept of sexual reproduction, how are we going to classify somebody who is produced by cloning then? Is there not a risk that we might not include him in the human race?
Yes, I'm talking about personhood. Dame Warnock herself, a year after she had written, a year after the famous report, herself expressed concern about she feared the instrumental use where the would be used for other people's ends rather than the end in itself, unless the embryo is granted full status from conception. Thank you.
So, concluding remarks now from both of you, please. That's all right. It's feel free to comment on anything that has been said. I mean, Dr. Rashad made quite a long speech and he raised so many points there, for example.
I think it's only fair that Dr. Germain will have the final word. So I will start off. Assuming, of course, we're moving at the same speed of light. I think that your comments were interesting, certainly food for thought. I think you proved, in a way, that scientific facts cannot give us a reason to define the nature of the embryo. You mentioned a complement of 3 times 26, and I assume you're referring to the polar body. because the second meiotic division occurs, yes, after fertilization, and this is the whole concept of why we would actually want to define life as starting at the zygote, so that we can utilize that polar body. I do not think that the number of chromosomes would define a human person. There are certainly people who do not have 46 chromosomes. Some have 45, some have 46, some have 47. And that does not make them any different than other people. And certainly some have chromosomal defects. So there's, besides the quantitative, there's the qualitative aspect of chromosomes. And that does not make them persons any less. And then there's the concept which was brought up as a question of cloning. I can take a muscle cell, which has 46 chromosomes. Now, to put it in non-scientific terms, you have to imagine that the cell is only using part of its chromosomes. It's like having a CD where only one track is being played. And in cloning, the DNA is manipulated again so that the whole CD starts to play, as in the zygote. But you take, anyway, it's the same chromosome. It's the same chromosome number which you take, you manipulate, and you put that nucleus into the enucleated ovum, and therefore you create a clone. And we see that as a human being, of course, in the ontological sense, and as human life, because we look at the nature of that clone. So certainly I cannot look at all the cells in my body which have a nucleus and say that they are that in their nature they are human beings or human life. Certainly I cannot do that. Otherwise it would be morally problematic to remove your appendix. But certainly if you clone a cell, then you have to see it not in its scientific entity, but in the nature. And I like to bring up the I'm sure you'll be familiar with the Wittgensteinian concept of a chair made of wood. That chair is made of wood. We say it is a chair, not because it is made of wood, because the same wood a month earlier was a tree. And from a tree you have converted the same substance into a chair, but you look at it in its nature. So before it had the nature of a chair, of a tree, and now it has the nature of a chair, although it is the same material which was manipulated in a certain way. And that is how I would look at cloning. Certainly it is human life. I would stick to my guns, however, on the issue of DNA as being the template. I would doubt whether consciousness would exist at that stage.
The object of my talk was to clarify the anomaly that exists between legal recognition of a born and an unborn, because physically I see no difference at all between a fetus that is about to be born and a fetus that has just been born. The distinction is man-made, and the idea behind the paper is to make a plea for legal recognition of unborn as well as born life in order to restore some semblance of common sense. Because it makes no sense at all for the law to recognize fully a baby that has just been born, but not fully immediately before it is born. That is what the whole scope of my talk. As I said in my introductory paragraph, the scientific and the philosophical part of my talk were a preliminary, an overview of the stuff that would lead me to a conclusion about the anomaly that exists between the recognition of born and unborn. And the conclusion of my talk has been the plea for whoever is responsible for making laws to recognize this fact and to enact appropriate legislation. Thank you.